Greetings and Porkvellian mastications, my leukocentrically plutarch listeners, and welcome to this September 2018 Science News Update. I'm your host for this barbarically inarticulate science podcast segment, Jim Campanella. I have absolutely no introductory remarks tonight, ladies and germs, so let's just get on with the show. Okay, so I have no idiot scientist of the month this month, but I read an article recently that really asked the question of whether I have a right to be singling out scientists as idiots. The article appeared in Laboratory News under the heading Science Life. It was not attributed to any particular writer, so I can only assume that it was an editorial written by the managing editor, whose name is Phil Prime. So, the story concerns the Darwin Awards and gender bias. So what exactly do I mean by that? Well, first, if you don't know what the Darwin Awards are, they are a semi-serious accolade given to recognized individuals who have supposedly contributed to human evolution by self-selecting themselves out of the gene pool. Silly as the awards themselves may be, the Darwin Award Committee are serious about it. They firmly state, quote, "Winners must die in such an idiotic manner that their action ensures the long-term survival of the species by selectively allowing one less idiot to survive," unquote. There have been many illustrious winners since the inception of the awards back in 1985. For example, there was an adventurous commuter who decided to hitch a ride home by attaching a shopping cart to the back of a commuter train, only to be dragged 2 miles to his death before the train was able to stop. Then there was the guy who shot himself in the head to show his friend he did indeed have a real functioning gun. And here's my personal favorite, the terrorist who mailed a letter bomb, with insufficient postage, and who, on its return, unthinkingly opened up his own letter and blew himself up. Slightly cruel, yeah, funny, yeah, but is there anything more than a few cheap laughs here is really the question. So here is the heart of the story. Doctors Dennis and Ben Lendrum, father and son of the Institute for Cellular Medicine, published a paper recently in the British Medical Journal in which they analyzed data from the Darwin Awards. The data they analyzed had to do with gender and risk-taking behavior. Now, based on the Darwin Awards, they found men seek out risk much more often than women. And every one of you out there is thinking, does someone really have to do statistics to figure that one out? But the Lendrum team did not just study normal risk-taking. They examined an altogether more enigmatic phenomenon called idiotic risk. Dennis Lendrum says, quote, "There is a qualitative difference between the risk of contact sports or adventure pursuits like parachuting. And then there's actual idiotic risk. We define idiotic risks as senseless risk where the apparent payoff is negligible or non-existent, and the outcome is often extremely negative and often final," unquote. The Lendrums point out that to date there has been no systematic analysis of sex differences in idiotic risk-taking behavior. Keen to fill this conspicuous void in human knowledge, they set out to fix that. And, I have a feeling you already know the result of their statistical analysis. After rating the past 20 years of Darwin Award data and applying some simple statistics, they found males accounted for 88.7% of Darwin Award winners. The Lendrums say there are probably several potential flaws in their study. Quote, "We understand there could be problems with our study's retrospective nature and how we gathered our data, or the fact that women may be more likely to nominate idiot men, or that there may be some selection bias within the Darwin Awards Committee itself. However, we do not feel that any of these factors would affect the results by very much," unquote. All this only goes to show that humans in general are idiots. For those listeners who have pestered me several times over the last few months about why I make fun of scientists who are idiots, my only response is that they are fodder for greater idiocy than most, because we simply expect more of them. Scientists are supposed to be educated, to be logical, to be careful, to keep perspective, and to have common sense. A lot of my colleagues out there who have outed themselves as idiots lack one or more of those traits. But I guess, based on the Lendrum study, it would be really interesting to question how many of those idiot scientists are male versus female. I suspect, as painful as it may be to contemplate, that we can probably guess what the answer is. Okay, the first real story of the night, it pretty much blew my mind when I read it. I have been under general anesthetic a couple of times in my life, for surgery and for colonoscopy. Both times I was freaked out by the utterly dead nature of being put under. It's not like sleeping at all, if you've ever actually experienced it. You just slide off into a death-like, dreamless unconsciousness. The existential implications of this death-like state have bothered me for a number of years. We won't go into that, though. But the study I'm going to tell you about clarifies a huge number of questions of what happens to your brain under anesthetic. When people are administered anesthetic, they seem to lose consciousness, or at least they stop reacting to their environment. But is consciousness lost fully during anesthesia, or does consciousness persist in the brain but in an altered state? Until reading the story, I mean, since I've experienced it, I would have said there's no consciousness present at all. But this question has been explored in the research project entitled The Conscious Mind: Integrating Subjective Phenomenology with Objective Measurements. It came out of the University of Turku in Finland, and they were studying neural mechanisms of human consciousness. And it came out this July in the journal Anesthesiology. The study was headed by Dr. Harry Scheinen. And basically, they examined the changes caused in the brain by anesthetics. And they monitored this with electroencephalograms and also positron emission tomography. In the first part of the study, healthy voluntary participants were anesthetized either with dexmedetomidine or propofol. The drugs were administered with computer-driven target-controlled infusions until the subjects just barely lost responsiveness. And from that state, the subjects could be woken up with light shaking or a loud voice without changing the drug infusions. Immediately after the subjects regained responsiveness, they were asked whether they experienced anything during the anesthesia period. The study subjects were played Finnish sentences during the anesthesia. Half of those sentences ended in an expected word and half in an unexpected word, such as, "The night sky was filled with shimmering tomatoes." Normally, when a person is awake, the unexpected word causes a response in the EEG, which reflects how the brain processes the meaning of the sentence and the word. The researchers tested whether the subjects detected and understood words or entire sentences while under anesthesia. The responses in the EEG showed that the brain cannot differentiate between normal and bizarre sentences when under anesthesia. When they used either drug, the expected words created a significant EEG response, meaning that the brain was trying to interpret the meaning of the words. However, after the participants woke from the anesthesia, they did not remember the sentences they had heard. The subjects were also played unpleasant sounds during anesthesia, and after they woke up, the sounds were played again, and surprisingly, they reacted faster to these sounds than to new sounds they had not heard before. They recognized the played sounds better than by chance, even though they could not actually recall them spontaneously. Scheinen says, quote, "We must conclude that the brain can process sounds and words during anesthesia, even though the subject does not recall it afterwards." This goes against the commonly held belief that anesthesia requires full loss of consciousness and disconnects the patient from the environment, unquote. So the study findings indicate that consciousness is not necessarily fully lost during anesthesia, even though the person is no longer reacting to the environment. However, dreamlike experiences and thoughts must still float in consciousness. The brain might still register speech and try to decipher words, but the person does not remember or understand them consciously. and the brain cannot construe full sentences from them. Scheinem finishes with this, quote, "The state of consciousness induced by anesthetics seems similar to natural sleep. While sleeping, people dream and the brain observes the occurrences and stimuli in their environment subconsciously. However, the reason that dreaming and other stimuli are not remembered after anesthesia is that amnesia is induced by the anesthetics themselves," unquote. Next story. Okay, last flu season was a fiasco because the wrong flu strains were chosen to make the vaccine, and so many people got sick who otherwise would not have done so. This story is to make you feel a bit better for the future of flu vaccines, and that we may never even have flu seasons again if the University of Pennsylvania's plan works out. University of Pennsylvania researchers will start clinical trials of a universal mRNA flu vaccine within the next 2 years, on the back of promising results from tests in multiple animal models. Unlike traditional vaccines that need to be reformulated every year to match mutated viral proteins and the different viral strains, as we've discussed, the new lipid nanoparticle, LNP, encapsulated mRNA vaccine triggers strong antibody responses to a part of the viral hemagglutinin, the HA protein, that doesn't mutate and is conserved across all viral strains. Experiments show that the mRNA LNP vaccine protected mice against deadly doses of three different flu strains. The overall results suggest that it may be feasible to generate mRNA vaccines against flu that only need one or two repeat administrations over a lifetime rather than the current yearly shots that we need. The paper describing the animal work was just published in Nature Genetics by Dr. Drew Weissman. He claims, quote, "This vaccine was able to do something that most other candidate flu vaccines have never been able to do. It was able to elicit protective responses against a conserved region that offers broad protection. If it works in humans even half as well as it does in mice, well, then the sky's the limit. It could be something that everyone uses in the future to protect themselves from flu," unquote. As we've discussed ad nauseum, current seasonal flu vaccines use viral proteins to elicit an antibody response that protects against future exposure to the virus. However, most flu virus vaccines trigger antibody responses against the ever-changing globular head region of the viral HA protein. This hemagglutinin HA domain readily mutates within any one virus strain, while different flu strains that might be predominant from one flu season to the next will have different HA head structures. It means that flu vaccines have to be reformulated every year, based on predictions of the most likely strains that will be prevalent in the coming season. Again, ad nauseum. As an alternative approach to current vaccines, the UPenn team developed that mRNA vaccine that encodes the HA proteins. So following injection, the recipient's immune system, their cells, take up the mRNAs and translate them into copies of the HA protein, which then acts as a much better foil for flu infection and triggers a much stronger protective antibody response. Initial tests in mice show that a single injection of the UPenn team's candidate vaccine elicited strong antibody responses against both the readily mutated HA head, but also against the conserved stalk region of the HA protein, which doesn't really mutate very much, and which is very little altered between strains. Weissman says, quote, "When we first started testing this vaccine, we were blown away by the magnitude of the antibody response. The vaccine elicited similar high levels of HA stalk reactive antibodies when tested over 30 weeks in rabbits and ferrets and mice," unquote. Encouragingly, the vaccine protected mice against subsequent infections with different flu virus strains. Animals given just one injection of an mRNA vaccine encoding H1 virus subtype proteins survived otherwise lethal doses of the same H1 flu virus, and a more distantly related H1 strain, while two doses were protective against an unrelated H5N1 flu strain. Weissman finishes with, quote, "The next step is to test this in non-human primates and humans. It should also be possible to generate even more potent vaccines based on combinations of HA antigens. If we were to combine our vaccine approach with newly developed HA stalk antigens, it would probably lead to a really good universal vaccine. Production of these new vaccines could also be faster. FDA-approved vaccines against new pandemic viruses take up to 6 months to be synthesized. On the contrary, once the genetic sequence of the target HA antigen is known, we can produce mRNA LNP vaccines within weeks." Unquote. Onward and upward. Dr. Jonathan Cedernes of Uppsala University just published a paper in the journal Science Advances that basically said, if you miss sleep, you will pay for it later. Just one night of sleep loss can trigger tissue-specific, epigenetic, gene expression, and metabolic changes that are associated with the loss of lean muscle and the increase of fat. The research involving human volunteers, who were allowed either a good night's sleep or who were kept awake all night, hints at molecular mechanisms and disruption to the circadian clock that may underpin the previously identified link between chronic sleep loss, weight gain, metabolic syndrome, and type 2 diabetes. Cedernes says, quote, "Our research group was the first to demonstrate that acute sleep loss in and of itself results in epigenetic changes in the so-called clock genes within each tissue that regulate its circadian rhythm. Our new findings indicate that sleep loss causes tissue-specific changes to the degree of DNA methylation in genes spread throughout the human genome. Our parallel analysis of both muscle and adipose tissue further enabled us to reveal that DNA methylation is not regulated similarly in these tissues in response to acute sleep loss." Unquote. The researchers acknowledged that their study involved just 15 healthy young males, and they only evaluated the effects of a single night's sleep loss. Further studies will be needed to see if the effects of short-term sleep loss are recapitulated after chronic sleep deprivation in more diverse groups of people, including younger and older men and women of different ethnicities. Whether the effects can be reversed by better sleep also remains to be seen. Cedernes notes, quote, "It will be interesting to investigate to what extent one or more nights of recovery sleep can normalize the metabolic changes that we observe at the tissue level as a result of sleep loss. Diet and exercise are factors that can also alter DNA methylation, and these factors can thus possibly be used to counteract adverse metabolic effects of sleep loss." Unquote. Okay, so the next story just annoyed the blazes out of me as being so silly I cannot even believe it was published. If this was not published in an actual science journal, and a relatively well-known one, I would have nominated the authors for Idiot Scientists of the Month. But you decide. First, a bit of background on experimental design. To avoid biased results in experiments, especially in dealing with humans, doctors working with patients and experimental treatments have used two different types of experimental designs, and you may have heard of these. The first are called blind studies. These are studies in which none of the treated patients know what treatment they're getting. This is to avoid problems with the placebo effect. Remember, the placebo effect is when patients who get a non-functional treatment get better. So the second type of medical study is a double-blind study. This is designed not only to avoid the placebo effect, but to avoid bias on the part of the researchers as well. In a double-blind study, neither the researcher nor the patient knows what treatment they are getting until the end. Well, the experimenters in the next story used neither type of design, and you judge for yourself if any of this makes any sense. The story comes out of the lab of Dr. Vanya Apkarian of Northwestern University Medical School, and it must be good science because it was published in Nature Communications this month. Right? Sure? Right? Well, Opcarian's team has demonstrated that it is possible to predict if a patient will respond to placebo sugar pills for chronic pain based on their brain's anatomy and psychology. This could lead to being commonplace for doctors to prescribe sugar pills for people. Now, this echoes my complaints of last month of one of the stories, which you may remember. So, sugar pills as painkillers. Wait, is this a punchline to a joke? No, seriously. Well, let me explain. Opcarian says that a person's biology will respond to the placebo whether they know what it is or not, meaning there is no need to trick a patient into believing that they have been given an active drug. Opcarian says, quote, certain brains are already tuned to respond to placebos. They have the appropriate psychology and biology that puts them in a cognitive state that as soon as you say, this may make your pain better, well, their pain becomes better, unquote. In order to investigate this, the team randomly split 60 chronic back patients into two groups. In one group, they were assigned a placebo, and those in the other group were assigned nothing. Already, you see a problem. Both treatment groups knew exactly what they were getting. Nothing, or, well, nothing. How do you justify the results of a study in which you actually have no real controls? But what controls do you need when you test if a sugar pill can kill pain? Do you administer actual painkillers to one group? Do you give another group two sugar pills? Do you lie to a group and tell them that the sugar pills will actually make them sick? How do you actually perform a study as inane as this? Anyway, the results, well, those whose pain decreased as a result of the placebo sugar pill had similar brain anatomies and psychological traits, according to Opcarian. The right side of their brain was larger than their left, and they were emotionally self-aware and sensitive to painful situations. Opcarian says, quote, our research could not only reduce healthcare costs if sugar pills are to be prescribed, but also lead to a reduction of side effects by the prescription of non-active drugs. Also, in the future, drug trials could be optimized by the elimination of the placebo effect and the need to recruit fewer people by identifying people prone to this reaction, unquote. Yeah, and you're also going to give them diabetes too with all those sugar pills. I don't know. This just seems so sad to me. So, let's do the last story of the night here. As usual, I saved the most controversial and titillating story for last. This one is definitely PG-13, so if you're listening with kids, you may want to just skip ahead a few minutes to the ending if you're listening to the Starship Sofa. So as a geneticist, I constantly come up against the question of nature versus nurture in both the classroom and my own work. The question always arises of what part does the environment play, if any, for any particular genetic trait. My first lecture in introductory genetics is a long explanation of how two organisms can have exactly the same genetic makeup, genetic twins, and yet have very different phenotypes, that is, traits, if they are raised under different environmental conditions. This is always in the background whenever you're talking about genetics, and it can become very controversial when you're talking about humans. For example, there are camps that insist that homosexuality is a learned trait versus one that is hardwired by genetics. Of course, there are others who insist the exact opposite is true. The reason this is so controversial is because it has to do with human behavior. And the genetics of behavior are some of the most complex that exist. And no matter what we discover in animals, it's never entirely clear that what we're finding in the animals can be extended to humans. Humans are far more complex than animals will ever be. How complex? Well, a new study out of Ohio State University suggests that the immune system may actually have an effect on sexual behavior in the developing brain. No one has ever considered the immune system to be a factor in neural development before, So this pretty much changes everything. The study was published by Dr. Catherine Lentz last month in the Journal of Neuroscience in an article entitled, "Mast Cells in the Developing Brain Determine Adult Sexual Behavior." The study shows that immune cells appear to play an important role in determining whether an animal's sexual behavior will be more typical of a male or a female. To better understand the role of the mast cells in sexual behavior, Lentz's team silenced the mast cells in male fetal rats and then observed the rats' development later in life. Mast cells are those immune tissues that you normally associate with allergies because they release histamine. At any rate, the altered male rats were paired with females that were receptive to mating and observed to determine whether the males sexually pursued the females. Interestingly, the experimental males were far less interested in the female rats than typical males, and they indeed acted almost like females. Moreover, the researchers also manipulated female newborn rats, activating the mast cells with a stimulating chemical. And as adults, they apparently acted like males. At this point, you're all going, "What? Is that all it takes?" Well, Lentz says, quote, "It's fascinating to watch because these masculine females don't have the hardwire to engage in male reproductive behavior, but you wouldn't know it from the way they act. They appear to be strongly motivated to try to engage in male sexual behavior with other females," unquote. Lentz found that the hormone estradiol, which plays a significant role in the development of masculine traits in rats, activates mast cells in the brain, and that those mast cells drive the animal's sexual development. The article states that newborn male rats had greater numbers and more activated mast cells in the preoptic area, a brain region essential for male copulatory behavior, than female littermates during the critical period for sexual differentiation. Lentz believes that if human development mirrors what was seen in this animal study, it's possible that relatively minor influences, such as an allergic reaction, an injury, or even inflammation during pregnancy, could steer sexual behavior development in offspring. He thinks it's even conceivable that taking antihistamines or pain relievers during pregnancy could play a role. Furthermore, this discovery could help explain risks for psychiatric and neurological disorders that are more common in males, including autism. Lentz remarks, quote, "These mast cells in the brain appear crucial for lifelong brain development, even though there are relatively few of them. This should really open our eyes to the potential role of different immune cells in the human brain. There's so much we don't know, and we need to pay attention to all the cells of the brain and how they talk to each other," unquote. What's particularly interesting here is that previous neurogenetic work by researchers uncovered that microglial development directs sexual behavior. Amazingly, in this new study, Lentz found that mast cells activate microglia. Lentz finishes with, quote, "This new mast cell discovery is one of those accidents of science. Another researcher was conducting some unrelated work on sex differences in gene expression and noticed that there appeared to be some differences in mast cell genes depending on whether the brains were from a male or female. We just followed up on that study," unquote. Well, that's all from me for now. Please don't complain there were only biology stories this month. Don't miss out on your sleep. Please don't take idiotic risks. Keep watching the skies, and I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.